I love democracy. I know somebody's going to say it would be a good idea if we had it, but I love democracy and I love elections. I believe in democracy. And when I say I believe, I mean it within the full context of belief. It's a faith statement. Because democracy, on some reasonable level, it's kind of like the bumblebee. It shouldn't work as well as it does. And it works amazingly well, even though it can wander off and people can make bad choices. There's usually an opportunity to engage those choices and remedy those choices. And in this democracy, the chances are that if you lose an election, or if it's stolen instead of lost, that you're still going to live to campaign another day, to run another day, to organize another day, to make your voices heard another day. The philosophers did not unanimously think that democracy was a good idea. Aristotle was not crazy about it. Socrates was not crazy about it. He thought that the will of the people was suspect because it came from the people. And that philosophers and smart guys, and they did mean guys, would make the best decisions, and the best form of government was benign tyranny. Well, if best means most efficient, that's probably true. But there are a couple of problems. One is best doesn't necessarily mean most efficient, and it's hard to keep despots benign. Tyrants tend to get very full of themselves, and we can look all over the world at people who may have started from revolutionary or democratic roots and then found themselves and the power and the perks indispensable and decided that they would be in office forever. So elections have consequences. Elections are good things, even if they're not perfect things. Our democracy depends on what we used to just call the law of large numbers, which is a faith statement. It is, if you take a bunch of people who don't necessarily know very much or understand very much, and you put them all together, somehow this will transubstantiate into wisdom. We call it today, with our computer language, crowdsourcing. So we crowdsource our wisdom in a democratic process, and we have elections. I don't always agree with the results, that's putting it mildly, but I really respect most of the process, even with some of the flaws that I'll get to in a little bit. It's almost like the jury system in that it works better than you think it reasonably should. I remember I was researching a book, and I spent 2 years in civil courts, and I saw juries do some fairly strange things, but most of the time, they wrestled with the right issues, and even if they came to conclusions that I didn't particularly think warranted, I really gained respect for how seriously people engage the issues. And I gained respect for how people engage the great issues in our society, the great issues that many have already voted on and the rest of us will vote on Tuesday. I respect our part of the process. The political and the politicians and the money's part of the process is a little bit more difficult. As a registered and card-carrying pundit, I enjoy the horse race part. I enjoy all of the spin, the negativity, the distortions. Are all a great deal of fun to look at, to think about, to write about. I do probably, during an election season, 3 columns for LA Media News group on the election process, which is more a processor where you put truth in and it gets shredded and comes out unrecognizable mush. But it's kind of an interesting sport. But the patriot in me, and I am a patriot, hence the red, white, and blue, the patriot in me says this stuff and the way we conduct our elections is bad for the soul of the nation and the body politic. That the amount of money that's in the process, that is used to smear, to distort, to hide the truth is very, very disturbing. And I'm going to get more into that at the end of this talk. The mud from all of these elections and distortions, and you know, I know what I am, what are you, and what you say bounces, I'm rubber, you're glue, and all of the really sophisticated political talk that we have going on today is very disturbing. Most of us have been inundated with political ads. We've listened to the spin people, and the spin people are on both sides just trying to make things to their own advantage. And that is a little bit like our justice system, where we say if you have two sides and they're adversarial, they'll end up balancing. If you have two rooms of spinners, neither of which is telling the truth, we're supposed to discern somewhere in the middle where the truth lies and where the lies lie. And we're not bad at it, despite all the spin. But the mud that washes off of the body after an election, and I'm actually looking forward to Tuesday night at 8:01 when I hope there will be a result, and I hope the result will be large enough not to be disputable and not litigated so that we don't start out with another crippled administration. But washing my soul after all of this stuff is harder. It's harder because of a sense of disappointment that we can't do a better job of talking about real things. Both sides, and I don't want to do just complete moral equality, but let me give you two examples that I find particularly troublesome. And I'm hoping that we don't talk about them in terms of substance during the talk back, because I'm using them as examples. The example that the Romney people used on Obama, from Obama's speech, you didn't build that. And it became a mantra. It became a chant during the Republican convention with it. Of course, you built that business, and you built that business. How dare he say you didn't build? He was talking about infrastructure. And this was a distortion, and they knew it was a distortion, but it was a political gotcha. And the media didn't do its job in saying, that's a political gotcha, and it's not about what they're representing it is about. Now, let me also say that when Romney said, I don't have to worry about that 47%, we also, and by we I say, I'm saying media, we also misrepresented that context. He may have elitist views on lots of things, but the context of that one political quote was really very clear. 47% of the people are not going to vote for me whatever I do or say, so I don't have to worry about them, meaning their vote. Didn't mean that he was going to put them on an ice floe. It meant that you don't chase votes that you're not going to get. Romney was not going to spend the last week campaigning in Harlem. It wouldn't have been good use of his time. Obama was not going to spend the last week campaigning in Texas. It wouldn't have been good use of his time. But the spinners and the ads take the gotchas and the phrases out of context and give us all of these talking points and these little mantras that we can do on each other, instead of dealing with the fact that there are important ramifications to elections. Presidents have not as much power as they pretend to have when they're campaigning, which is shown whenever they have to run for re-election, and they haven't kept their promises. I promise you, no president will ever keep all of his or her promises. It can't happen because we were designed with the wisdom of the founders to be inefficient. We are the opposite of those efficient tyrannies. We're an inefficient, not tyranny, but an inefficient oligarchy where the contending branches of government are supposed to slow us down, are supposed to be a brake against popular passion, and one man or woman or branch of government completely stampeding people, because people are stampedable. There are reasons to defend inefficiency, even if it is hugely frustrating to us. There are reasons even to defend the Electoral College. I'll admit I have to stretch a little bit on this one, but I do pray. Two great faiths, no waiting. I do pray for whatever the powers that be, that we don't have a split between the electoral vote and the popular vote, as we did in the first George W. Bush election, because it would not be good for the body and soul of the nation. But the Electoral College was designed so that politicians would have to care about small states too, and that the big states and big population centers didn't just run roughshod over all of the little states. The Electoral College was designed so that a politician might every once in a while have to go to Alaska and maybe stay. Our present system, because of the electoral vote, my newspaper did an... I can't go there. Anyway, because of the electoral system, a lot of people in California say, my vote doesn't count because we know that California is going to be a blue state and Obama will get the electoral votes. Our votes do count. Saying that they don't count because we are predictably going to be Democratic is like saying, if I want to buy a $1 million house and I have $900,000 and I go out and I borrow or beg for the final $100,000, that the first $900,000 didn't count. Everybody's vote for president counts. And the Electoral College does a good thing for California. For those of us who live in Los Angeles and closer to where Democrats extract money, we have something that's called an Obama jam. An Obama jam is any time that Obama comes into town, the traffic is jammed, and Obama is not coming into town to campaign. He's coming in to use the California West Side ATM and extract money. When conservatives come to Orange County is the ATM, and you can have a Romney jam here. If we didn't have an Electoral College, we would be getting what the good folks in Ohio and Iowa and Wisconsin are getting all the time. They would be camped out in our major population areas, and we would be camped out on our freeways because nothing would move. Because they would be here not just for our money, but for our votes. So from a perfectly selfish viewpoint, the Electoral College protects us from the jams. It protects us from... The people in Iowa have had 78,000 ads, political ads, on TV in the last 2 weeks. The dead trees filling mailboxes, the bumper stickers being applied whether you want them or not, the dirty tricks, the robocalls, the counter-robocalls. You've all had robocalls, right? I mean, I have these people calling me all the time. Stand by for a word from the president. Stand by for a word from Congressman Ryan. Stand by. I used to get lovely calls from Arnold. Arnold called me all the time about how fantastic things were going, and I really appreciated it. And you have the robocalls, not simply at dinner, but do you know about the reverse robocalls? Those are the robocalls where a candidate pretends to be the other candidate and calls you at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, hi, I'm candidate X, and please vote for me, and then calls you at 2:05, and then at 2:20, you're going to vote for candidate Y because you're really annoyed with X. There's so much deception and double deception, all this stuff, that it is just, oh, let's bring this thing to an end, shall we please? But it still is our national communion. It still is our opportunity to be heard. Going and taking seriously the choices ahead of us are important. Seeing some of the good moments where people actually acted as if the country were more important than a particular election was just so good for body and soul. To see Christie and Obama as strange bedfellows, but bedfellows nonetheless, was a really lovely moment for Christie to say, you know, I don't care about this election, although he said it stronger in language not appropriate for this room. I care about my people who are drowning. And for him to switch from Obama can't find the light switch of leadership to you're doing a terrific job and I and the president's one. Now, you can take a cynical view of this, and some might. I'm not looking at anyone in particular. Some might say, well, Christie's doing it because he knows if he doesn't, that money might not be coming in. And Obama's doing it because he knows that he's looking presidential. All that being true, it is still so nice when our politicians are able to act, even if it is acting, like they like each other, like we're part of the same nation, like the small differences that we use to divide ourselves from each other are not as important as the fact that we are in this together, that we breathe the same air, drink the same water, depend on the kindness of strangers and the ability of a nation to organize itself, not just saving the people that look like you or sound like you politically or sound like you religiously, but just because of the inherent worth and dignity of every individual. Those brief shining moments are enough to recharge the batteries, to cover for a moment the cynical impulses, and to say, yes, we can. We can make democracy work despite the distortions, despite the money, despite the money that seems to drown out reason. Now, I'm about to tell you how to vote. And just to make sure that it's clear, I'm going to tell you how to vote from the pulpit. First, before I tell you how to vote, let's look at why I'm not allowed to tell somebody how to vote or for whom to vote. There's a difference which you'll catch. Maybe you just did. I have, as an American citizen, freedom of speech. I have freedom to express myself in terms of issues, policies, candidates, and individuals. My freedom of speech ends the moment I walk into this room. That hasn't always been true. This was an IRS ruling in 1954 that was promulgated by Lyndon Johnson. And it was an IRS ruling that was designed to attack churches and some Unitarian churches that were pro-civil rights. Back in the old days, the civil rights movement, conservatives went after liberals for misusing their religious congregations and told clergy, you better not use that pulpit for political purposes, which came as a big shock to Martin Luther King. They went after the tax-exempt status of First Unitarian Church in Los Angeles because Stephen Fritchman took political stands. Now, they ask clergy to play what's essentially a hypocritical game, which is we can talk about issues. So if I'm a Roman Catholic priest or cardinal, I can say to you, abortion is a sin. Don't vote for anybody who is not pro-life. And not only don't vote for them, don't come to the communion rail if you vote for them because you will not be in good faith. As a Catholic priest, I could not say for whom or against whom to vote, but that's a silly code. It turns clergy into hypocrites. And before you say we're already hypocrites, of course, we're human beings and have all the hypocrisy and all the passions of everybody else. I'm with my conservative colleagues on this. I don't believe my freedom of speech should stop at that door. I think that I should be free to take positions on candidates. And there are times when I would do what Steve Fritchman did, what Martin Luther King did, and put a 501c3 at risk, because rendering unto Caesar, sometimes there are things more important. And sometimes you put your tax-exempt status at risk at rare times. Clergy who take constant positions with great authority usually work against their own interests and the interests of a congregation. So it's something that would be done rarely. But the reason that there are tax-exempt institutions is because our founders believed that the ability to tax was the ability to put people out of business. And so that if they started taxing religious property, they would drive many of our religious institutions out of business. This temple, synagogue, could not afford to pay the retail taxes, that property taxes that would be demanded, because all of this could be torn down and turned into housing units. Our great cathedrals would be torn down. So the founders said, you should not be able to tax out of existence different religious institutions just because you don't like them. Well, somebody would argue, well, we never would, but we have tried to. They tried to pull the tax-exempt status of All Souls in Pasadena because their ex-priest made a political comment that was too partisan and seemed to be coming out against a particular candidate. They went after First Church in Los Angeles. They went after the Nation of Islam mosques and said, you can't have those mosques. We don't recognize you as a religion. However you may have felt about Elijah Muhammad or Louis Farrakhan, this was using a tax code to silence dissent. And I'm concerned about stuff like that. I think it's a much bigger issue than right and left. And right and left switched places on it. In the 50s, liberals were for using the pulpit. In the 70s, the scales fell from Jerry Falwell's eyes, and he said, no. What I said before about get back into your churches and sing your hymns and don't bother with social causes, I've had a further revelation. Now I want you to go out and get organized, at which point liberals said, maybe you ought to go back to your churches and sing your hymns and take up your collections and stay out of politics because your voices are getting too strong. I don't know how to separate religion and politics. It's how we lead our lives together. If my religion is not based on values, then my religion is not worth very much. If my values don't get expressed in the politics of how we live together, then I'm not practicing it. I don't want to give you political sermons week after week. I don't want to endorse or unendorse candidates. But the idea that that clergy of all faiths are made to speak in code seems silly. And if it had a reason, if it had a justification in terms of the tax-exempt status, and we don't want our churches and synagogues and mosques and ashrams just to be places where you can filter and launder your political money, that's a decent argument. And it was a decent argument that had some merit until Citizens United. Because post-Citizens United, as all of you know, I'm sure, $11 million just came in on two initiatives out of Arizona from a nonprofit that is doing politics, and we don't know who the contributors are. Corporations have free speech. Individuals have free speech. In this room, we don't. That's something at least to think about. So now, I'm going to tell you how to vote. Vote in person. I'm not telling you who to vote for. I'm telling you how. There's early voting. There's absentee voting. There's all kinds of things. But this is communion. Standing in line, even if they're bad lines. Fighting traffic, even if it's bad traffic. There is something unifying about doing the same thing on the same day and coming together with other caring Americans of all political persuasions, seeing each other at the polls, understanding that the person next to me may be canceling my vote, understanding that my wife in some times may be canceling my... It's okay. Because we see that we're in it together. I know that we know it in our heads, but it's important to see it and experience it. That's why we have a food collection as part of our service. We could have it outside in the narthex, but it's important for our kids to see and for us to see active caring. It's important for us to see each other at the polling station and know that we are involved, that democracy is not a big abstraction of philosophy. Democracy is people involved, believing to varying degrees at various times that what we have chosen makes a difference. That is the primary article of my faith and my affirmation of democracy and our social contract. If you don't vote, you give up your right to complain. And since I was born to kvetch, I will exercise that right every time there is an election. To the best of my ability, I will be informed. And to the best of my ability, I will seek wisdom and truth. And I know it's an incomplete information problem. And I know there are no perfect candidates. And I know that not all promises can be kept. But we have to do our part to make a good difference in tomorrow.